Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in Biography. Today, I'm speaking with Perry Merling, professor of international political economy at the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. We are discussing his recently published book, Money and Empire, Charles B. Kindleberger and the Dollar System, both a biography of a brilliant 20th century thinker and a history of the emergence of dollar hegemony. Money and Empire sheds light on the nature of money in the global system. Perry, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Happy to be here.
Of course. You know, it's great to talk with you. It's great to meet you. First, before jumping into the book, I should say that, anyone who finds this conversation interesting should definitely check out your Coursera course on economics of money and banking. I found it very, very useful. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your intellectual journey.
Oh, my journey to this point. This is actually my fourth book. It does build on everything that came before, as a matter of fact. My journey has always been about trying to understand how the monetary side of the economy works. And I found out in my graduate education at the LSE that economists are kind of puzzled about this, that the foundations of monetary theory are actually in bad shape. And so I decided to devote my life to it. I'm that sort of person. I decided that I needed to go back in economic history to find, like, when did people seem to have a handle on this? So my first book is an attempt to look for ancestors, I guess. And so the money interest and the public interest was, and that's, I guess, where I also kind of found this method of doing economics by doing intellectual biography, because it's sort of three generations, Alan Young, Alvin Hansen, and Ed Shaw. And it's the American institutionalist approach to monetary economics, which is very distinctive and is not really known, because most of the stories, they sort of begin with Britain or something, you know, and the Keynesian traditions or something. But the American institutionalists were very interesting because the U.S. didn't get a central bank until 1913, and yet they had banks, you know, and they had clearing and settlement and checks. So what's all that about? So they had to understand how the system worked without a proper central bank. And therefore, no particular, you know, the connections to the government were different and so forth. And so that's where I found my starting point. And that book did pretty well, got me tenure, and it got me started on the road. And then I started teaching money and banking, and the MOOC that you mentioned came out of that. I taught economics and money banking for 15 years before INET filmed that in the fall of 2012. So I would tell your listeners also, I think it still stands up as an analytical frame, but it's 10 years out of date. And so my fifth book, okay, is going to be an update of that, coming soon to a bookstore near you as soon as I write it. But I realized after I finished that first book, which is American Monetary Thought from 1920 to 1970, those three guys, you know, but that the story after 1970 was really about finance, the rise of modern finance. And so I had to teach myself modern finance. And so I did that by writing a biography of finance and through Fisher Black, So that was my second book, Fisher Black and the Revolutionary Idea of Finance. And then came the financial crisis, and Princeton Press came and said, you know, can you write us a book about the financial crisis? And so I wrote New Lombard Street in 6 months, which is basically came out of the course, the Coursera course. And when I, now I'm coming to this present book. So when that book was done, and I liked that book, but it was sort of a biography of the Fed. So I was still following this biographical kind of way of writing, but in this case, an institution, not an individual. When I came to the end of that book and it was published, I realized one big problem with this is that hanging the story of the global financial crisis on the life arc of the Fed kind of doesn't do it justice, because this was a crisis of the global dollar system, not really of the domestic. And so I need to write this book again, the same sort of arc from 1913 to the present, but now as a biography of the dollar. So I was writing, that's where I started. It was a biography of the dollar. But then I found Kindleberger, and I said, oh, I know Kindleberger really from my first book, because he had written some things with Hansen, and I interviewed him in his retirement home about Hansen. So he came from that world. That's the point. He came from this American institutionalist tradition, which I felt like I knew, you know, better than maybe anybody else, particularly for monetary economics. Certainly that was my expertise. So I felt, okay, this is a nice entry point. And his dates are perfect. He was born in 1910. So the Fed was born in 1913. And, you know, he started at MIT in 1948. Bretton Woods was 1944. So you can really follow, you mentioned in your lead-in that this is a biography of Kindleberger and a kind of biography of the rise of dollar hegemony. We'll talk about that word, hegemony, in a moment. So that's why it can be both of those things, because the dates kind of line up and the stories intertwine, because he sees his life project. I came to believe, I didn't start with that idea. He sees his life project as kind of doing for the global money system what his teachers at Columbia had done for what Willis, H. Parker Willis, had done for the United States, you know, unifying this disparate little monetary system and creating a central bank in New York, the New York Fed, and the Board of Governors and so forth. And so the arguments to him from an early age, the arguments for why it's a good idea to have kind of a unified monetary system within the United States are the same arguments for why it's a good idea to have a unified monetary system in the world. It's a little harder because we don't have world government. And that's the challenge. And that's the challenge that he accepted and spent his life kind of working toward. I wanted to write this fourth book because it seemed to me clear. I had already done money. I'd already done finance. It seemed to me international finance was the next thing that I needed to understand in order to understand the full monetary and financial side. So I spent 10, that's why it took me 10 years, because I had to master another field. And so the story, you mentioned that there are these two threads in the book. There's actually a third one too, which is a history of economic thought, okay, that it's talking about where did modern international finance come from? And what are its shortcomings maybe, too, and where, because Kindleberger was a critic of it, from the outside. And so it lets you see, you know, that there are other ways of thinking about the world than Mundell Fleming or the things that are in the textbooks, that, because he's coming from a period before all that stuff, before ISLM, you know, before the stuff you learned in college. And he knew how to think. Without writing down models or you know, running regressions on a computer. And so that was it's an old style, but it turned out to be, it's really, I must say, I'm very impressed by him. It's a very robust style, and he's able to roll with the punches and have an active scholarly life for a long, long time, even as economics followed this fad and then that fad and the other. So for a book like this, you need somebody who is a spider in the middle of the web, you know, so that they are connected And he was great that way because he had these three successive careers. And he was at MIT, which is became the center sort of economics, actually probably in the world. He was there before it was that important. He was also in the State Department. And so he's a good person to hang a story on.
I did find, some of the lines that you had quite interesting, seeing almost, ways in which maybe the similarities between the two of you, in a sense, his kind of approach to economics and his role in the broader economic world, and also some of the other work that you've done just with putting forward, the money view as this kind of alternative approach. You spend in the first couple chapters of the book, you talk a little bit about his childhood. I think without getting too much into depth of that, if people want to learn more about his childhood, you constantly refer to him over and over again, point out that he was a WASP. What was his childhood like, and did his early childhood, his early views shape things later on?
Well, he had a privileged childhood. His father was a sort of big time lawyer in New York, and he went to private school and went to the University of Pennsylvania. And I think he was really headed toward a career in international banking. That's kind of what he wanted to do, which would also have been a privileged life. No one would hire him right out of undergraduate, partly because he didn't know anything, but also because the Depression was just starting then. So the Depression was a very important turning point because his family finances all completely fell apart. So he was basically on his own after he graduated from college and had to find his own way. That led him to go to graduate school and then central banking, not private banking, but central banking at the New York Fed and the BIS. I think that that was a very formative experience. Central banking is also a very privileged life, as a matter of fact. He was traveling first class upgraded to first class when he went to the BIS across the ocean, because the liner discovered he was from the New York Fed, and they shipped all their gold with that liner. So they treated him like a celebrity. But then World War II intervened. And so that planned life, I think he would have happily spent his life in Basel, eating well and dining visiting central bankers. But World War II happened, and he managed to get back to the U.S. just in time. And he was the WASPy part. He had two admirals in his ancestry, and so I think he felt very much that it was his duty to engage with this war. And so he got involved before the U.S. declared war, and was actually kind of miffed when they made him come home in order to get basic training or whatever. He then went back, he loved working after D-Day. He went on the European continent, traveling with General Bradley. I think those were the highest points of his entire life. I imagine he could be rather tiresome about that. But I think it's true that it was the turning point. Then he returned, to economics via the State Department, getting involved in Marshall Plan and the reconstruction of Germany. He was important there. And 48, he left, he started MIT. And so that was his second career then, starting at MIT. And he really had to retool because he had been away from if you're following the dates, he'd been away from the academy really for 12 years. He'd been in public service. So he had to get going again. He did at MIT. And he was always grateful that they took a risk on him, taking somebody like that. And I suppose you could say he took a risk on them too, because MIT wasn't really much of anything at that time. Samuelson was there, but Solow wasn't there yet. It certainly was not the powerhouse that it became later. So he grew up with MIT. So you ask about this WASP background, his importance. I think the importance for a life that was very disrupted, okay, was that he had a lot of self-confidence and resilience. I think he felt that he was, you know, he was part of the American establishment in some way, so that he was comfortable. Even if he had no money, you know, he did not feel that he was oppressed. And he liked people. You know, maybe that's another kind of, he liked socializing, and he once pondered, he said he likes people more than he does like books and ideas. And I think that is kind of true. And held him back maybe a little bit, but he turned it into an asset because he wrote stories, you know, in economic history and stories for people, stories that people like to hear. You know, a lot of his later work, when he became an economic historian after he was mandatory retirement in 1976, that big book of his international finance essays is a lot of these are you know, festive entries or you know, keynote speeches or things like that. So they're talking to people instead of academic articles in which you're dotting every I and crossing every T and putting all the footnotes in and citing all the proper people. And so it was a different kind of a life. I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, I make a point of it. I think it's important, but I hadn't really tracked it. I'm making up some of this in conversation with you, but I think it's all in the book. You read the book, so I'm not telling you things that are new to you. I'm just trying to follow that thread. So now you're going to ask, am I a WASP? Okay, and because you started this with similarities, and I suppose that's true. That I am too. I did not grow up, however, with his self-confidence. Probably because my own family finances fell apart a decade earlier. So I was 11 instead of 21. Okay. So my formative experience of the world was in the 70s of the United States, and when I was 11 in 1970. Okay. So that was pretty bad time to be alive. Made me into an economist, I suppose. But you mentioned the money view. So let me just follow up on that. One of the reasons that I wanted to do Kindleberger is he is a key currency guy. Okay. He followed sort of John H. Williams, who was at Harvard and was vice president at the New York Fed when he was there. And I had a sense, I told you I wanted to teach myself international finance, and so I had to find a teacher, and Kindleberger is the one I found. And I really do think that the key currency approach, which is a minority approach and has always been, is the international version of the money view. That's the point, okay? That the money view that I had been trying to put together for 15 years, as I said, it was filmed in 2012, and that's when I then started to write this book. The international side, I really didn't know very much about. Those lectures on the international stuff were pretty preliminary in that course. So I've spent 10 years learning about it now, and that's the main thing that I have to update in the class. But it was everything I learned about international finance, I kind of learned from Charlie. And so that key currency view which is completely absent in the MOOC. I think I don't mention it at all. I even think maybe I didn't know about it. I didn't know of its existence. That's sort of shameful to say, but because I did think of myself as being really very well educated in the history of American monetary economics. So I knew of some of the people, James Angel, for example, who was Charlie's thesis supervisor at Columbia, okay, was actually a student of Alan Young. So Alan Young is the first guy I did in my first book that you asked about. His student, James Angel, was Charlie's thesis supervisor. So in a way, Charlie is a grandson of Alan Young following through. And Angel was a favorite student of Alan Young, as a matter of fact. And so there is a direct intellectual connection there. And so it's not surprising that I can integrate Kindleberger into my previous understanding of the monetary world. That's what I'm doing in my courses right now. You mentioned in the intro that I'm teaching it at the Pardee School. I took that job 5 years ago after 30 years in Manhattan, and I guess you're still in New York. So And I still have a life in New York. But the it seemed to me that in order to do international finance sort of properly, I needed to get out of the beating heart of it and understand what the rest of the world is. And so Party School is really a lot about the problems of the Global South. And we just had a conference about debt sustainability in the Global South and the kinds of problems that are happening. And so these, and the kind of call for de-dollarization, all that stuff, I don't think I would have really engaged with that if I had stayed in New York. But here, it's these are central topics. And so it's very exciting to keep pushing the ball forward, or maybe I should say rock up the hill, Sisyphus. So I'm having a second career in a way, you know, after 30 years in one. Instead of being forced to retire at mandatory retirement, I actually can stay in academia and have a second career.
With you know, talking about Charlie's second career, MIT in many ways was his second career, his first career being
public service.
Yeah. Public service. And you know, when he gets to MIT, you know, you mentioned that it wasn't necessarily you know, the department that it would later become. You know, and how did Charlie fit in with the rest of the economics department there? And how did his views approaches differ from most of the others?
Well, as I say, when he first came, there wasn't much of an economics department. So he was a backbone of it. And for the first, I think I mentioned in the, somebody counted up, he supervised like half of the theses. And then Bob Solow was hired almost soon after him. And Bob Solow hired, basically supervised the other half, you know. So the first 10 years of the department was a small number of people. There were also some political scientists there, and it was a general social science department. And as a service department for the engineers, the kids at MIT, and Samuelson's textbook, which was published in, I think, 48, was written for those students. How do you teach economics to engineering students? Well, by making it look like engineering, I guess. And that was not Charlie's approach at all. You know, he's coming from this American institutionalist tradition. And he wound up writing his own textbook, International Economics. I think really sort of push and pull, push because he lost his security clearance in this McCarthy period. So he was unable to have this job that he really imagined he was going to have with continuing on with the kind of stuff he was doing at the State Department and advising the Marshall Plan and so forth. He was unable to continue there, and he needed some money because he had four children, and MIT took a cut in pay to go to MIT. So the he wrote textbooks. So he wrote the International Economics textbook, so that's push. I think pull. I told you he was sort of retooling and trying to get up to speed on, you know, what had international economics become in the 12 years since he had last paid attention to it. So he had to do that work anyway. So he might as well turn it into a textbook. And so he did. He was always a very fast worker, maybe too fast in the sense that the first edition had so many errors in it, the students had to correct it all in the second edition. It went through many editions, so he was. I think that the original faculty of at MIT very much respected him and even really loved him. I think he was, they didn't understand him maybe because he was a different kind of economist. He was not running to the chalkboard and writing down equations. So how do you think if you aren't running to the chalkboard and running it? And so I think his process was a little opaque. They couldn't really understand what he was about, but he seemed like he knew stuff, you know, and had insights that were unavailable to people who thought, you know, you need to start with ISLM and then ring the changes on that. And so that's sort of how post-war economics got built. So as time went on and post-war economics got built, he became sort of more and more out of step with that because he stayed who he was. He stayed who he was, even as economics changed away from him. And the new crop of graduate students who came in when MIT decided to make a push to be the top department, They were all, they were mostly a little dismissive of this old guy who seemed like a has-been, and he's occupying a seat that really should belong to one of them. And so he got a little, you know, pushed out, I would say. They did a festa for him in 1971. He's only 60 years old. So the thanks very much for your service, Charlie. I'm older than that. So I feel what that must have been like. And that's when he began making, trying to find another audience. And I think the economic historians became that other audience that he, that book, World in Depression, which is his story about what caused the Great Depression. It's also sort of autobiographical because he grew up in the Great Depression. And so he was interested in what caused the Great Depression. He dedicates it to his father, who, I mean, so this is personal. His father lost all his money. You know, his family finances were destroyed by the Great Depression. So through no fault of his own. So that's something that he wants to understand. And the reception of that book, I think, showed him that there was a future audience outside of MIT. And so when he was forced to retire in 76, it actually opened up a whole world, and he was free to have a third career, which, as you mentioned, as a something of an economic historian, he, you know, was he an economic historian? He always said he was a historical economist, not an economic historian, because he never went into the archives. He never dug up new facts. The way I understand him, really, is that what he was doing as an economic historian is more or less the same thing he was doing as an intelligence officer in the OSS, which is just, you know, gather all the intelligence, all of it, you know, interviews with prisoners and photographs and all of it, read it all, and then say, what does it add up to? You know, where are the Germans building those bombers? And tell the generals, and hopefully they'll go and bomb them. And that's basically the style he was as an economic historian. He's depending on actual economic historians as sort of field agents doing the research, finding the raw data, bringing it to him, and then he's sifting it through in order to find out what the actual story is. And then he develops this method where he's not, you know, his last book before he died is a collection of his greatest hits, and it's titled Comparative Political Economy. So he actually, I think, came to think of himself as a comparative political economist. And that's because he's comparing historical narratives across time. Same country here, same country 100 years later, and also across countries. Same. How did different countries respond to the shock of the United States wheat harvest entering the world market? You know, that's actually one of his first forays into economic history. And he sees this as a way of doing economics, as a way of finding out what are the dependable economic laws. And there are maybe not very many of them, but they're maybe very deep, and we can build on those foundations instead of shaky foundations like utility curves and production functions and things like that, which are created from, they don't kind of exist in the world. So you can create some pretty rickety structures. So he's looking for robust economic laws, in his third career outside of academia. Well, he was still teaching at Brandeis and at Middlebury and so forth. But he's outside of MIT, and so he can do whatever he wants, right? He's he does. He takes advantage of the independence that comes after 65, and continued to write basically up until just a few years before he died. That's that story.
Something that seems very, you know, clear throughout is that he was always, he was very interested in history, he was always engaged in present day issues. One of the most important things at his time was that, you know, he saw the establishment of the Bretton Woods Agreement and eventually the collapse of the gold backed dollar. I'm wondering, you know, what did Charlie think about the Bretton Woods Agreement? And then maybe as like a sort of a second question for listeners, because I'm sure this is what some might be thinking, is, you know, what did he think of Robert Triffin's famous critique?
The key currency view, which Charlie would have imbibed, maybe not so much from Angel, but certainly from when he was at the New York Fed under John H. Williams, sees the dollar system emerging from business practice already, okay, already in the 20s even, okay, and central bankers are seeing this and trying to manage the transition from a sterling standard pre-World War I, which seems to have been come to an end, and to manage that transition to the dollar standard system. As early as 1933, the World Economic Conference. So Charlie knew all about that, and he was hired by the New York Fed really to backstop the tripartite agreement of 1937. So which was to stabilize sterling against the dollar. So that's in his mind. From that point of view, what Bretton Woods did in 1944 was to sort of bless the emerging dollar standard system. It wasn't sort of creating from the head of Zeus, you know, this international monetary system that we're designing. It wasn't designed, okay? It was Darwinian evolution, institutional evolution that created it. And Bretton Woods is really a moment when the countries are all recognizing this, that is the way the post-war order might look. Remember that Bretton Woods was held right after D-Day, really, shortly after D-Day, when Charlie is on the continent with Bradley. So he was not there. He's not paying attention to that. He's still trying to win the war. Okay. And that's important. Whereas Triffin, who's almost exactly his contemporary, had spent the war basically at the New York Fed. He was there. He wasn't at Bretton Woods, but he immediately joined the new IMF that had been created, which he imagined was created by these ministers as the new world central bank. And so that's almost exactly the opposite of Charlie's frame. And so they were inevitably going to tangle. Okay. And that tangling happened, I think, actually repeatedly, although not very publicly, almost immediately, because Charlie certainly never thought, you know, what Triffin thought was that the U.S. had agreed to let the IMF be the central bank. And the U.S. never thought they'd agreed to any such thing. And that, in fact, the key currency idea is instantiated in the Marshall Plan, you know, in unilateral actions by the leader, by the United States, and the reconstruction of Europe to integrate the European economy with the United, and also the Anglo-British loan that happened too, which Charlie was a part of. He was at the State Department when that happened. So he sees the construction of the international monetary system as happening along key currency lines, and it's working. So when Triffin comes along in the late 50s, he spends most of the 50s actually in Europe building the European payment system and so forth. And when Triffin comes along and says, oh no, there's this dilemma that in fact national currencies cannot be international reserves. Really, we need the IMF to do this, and there's this fundamental problem that a national currency, in order to get lots of it in circulation, the country has to run deficits, and of course that makes the country weak, and so this is not sustainable. And Charlie thought it's perfectly well sustainable. That's exactly how the sterling system worked in the 19th century, with the center in London, and that there's no reason why the dollar system can't work with its center in New York, and that's what the bankers are trying to build, and why don't we just let them get on with it, you know? But so he was upset that Triffin's ideas got picked up by President Kennedy and in fact economists more generally, and so there was all this effort to basically keep New York from being the bond market for Europe and create barriers to capital flows in and out. And ultimately, 1971, Nixon took the dollar off gold, and then 1973 embraced flexible exchange rates. So the politicians killed the dollar system, you know, or tried to kill it. Okay. And the economists gave them aid and succor. And that was that was bad. he was upset about that, and particularly because he feared that the 1971 was a parallel to 1931 when sterling went off gold, and the result was a Great Depression. Okay, in this case, the dollar went off gold, and the result was the Great Stagflation. So it was inflation, not deflation. But it was a pretty rocky time, as I've mentioned, that my formative years, and was only put back together again, you know, but the Volcker shock in 1979, you know, which for youngsters like you, you don't remember double-digit interest rates. You remember a decade of ZIRP and zero interest rate policy. So and we're moving away from that right now. So you watch what's going to happen. So he was definitely following current events and using what he. So, and again, that's like this intelligence analyst sort of model. Like you're using what you know, everything you know, all the data you know, all of the, in order to try to give the best advice you can to the generals. Okay. And that's what he was trying to do. And he gave them the best advice he could, and they ignored it. And so that about the dollar I'm talking about here. And they ignored it. But that didn't mean he stopped. You know, he was a loyal American, and that meant not going along to get along, okay, but continuing to be a pain in the ass and saying, you know, I really don't think that's such a good idea, you know, and looking for an opportunity, looking, how can I find an ear that might be willing to listen, or so that when, you know, when the economist's infatuation with flexible exchange rates met the reality of flexible exchange rates, and it didn't work out all that great, you know, that created an opening for him. Okay. And so those books on the essays on international finance, international money, became possible. Okay. Because he got an audience. And the economists even ultimately embraced him. They elected him president of the American Economic Association. Remember, he was an outsider. And so that all came as a big surprise to him. But I think it was the economists recognizing that, you know, Charlie was actually kind of right about some stuff, and we didn't really listen to him. I think they, you know, it was hard to listen to him because he was not speaking the language of standard economics. But it was not hard for me to listen to him because I had already, you know, been in the American institutionalist world. So as far as I could kind of understand him. So my job in this book was to kind of, I am a modern economist. I have a standard PhD, and so I can translate. I can be the one who can translate from, and that's what I kind of do in the book, I hope, is to make these ideas accessible, point out the way in which they are the international extension of the money view, and so that at a time really like now, when we're having eyes are turning to the future of the international monetary system, here are some ideas from the past that maybe are newly relevant, that you might want to, if you picked up Kindleberger, you know, something he wrote, you would probably not have an easy time really understanding it. So let me help you. Okay. I've read everything that Kindleberger ever wrote, which is a lot. So I have distilled it in, so you don't have to, or you can let me direct you to particular books or particular papers, and then go back to the original, as you like. I think it is very important to pay attention to events and to use what you know to try to learn, you know, what as a test of your knowledge too. Like if my theory is any good, I should have something to say that is relevant, you know, in the modern period. That's what I think anyway. So I don't think economics is a purely academic discipline. It should be talking about events, things that are happening now, and should be constantly tested against them. In my classes, I mean, it sounds like you dipped into the online course. You know that in my classes, Economic and Money and Banking, I begin every single lecture with an impromptu lecture on some article in the FT that day, the Financial Times that day. I created that push-pull. You know, one was, I thought, your students seem to like this. It gets them to class on time. But the other is that it's a discipline for me that it forced me, you know, frankly, in years when I'm not, or semesters when I'm not teaching that class, I don't read the FT every day because I'm not thinking, what article am I going to use today? So it's actually a good intellectual discipline to force you to use what you're teaching to make sense of what's happening right now, breaking news right now. You know, when the global financial crisis was breaking, okay, breaking news in the fall of 2007, you know, I was reading the FT and talking about it. And that's a lot of my work comes out of that, then distilling that. And I didn't learn that so much from Kindleberger. That really came from Minsky. Because I knew Minsky read the financial press every day and was always commenting on it. And I thought, you know, that would be a good practice for me. Since I don't actually live in a bank, I'm not, you know, I'm kind of distant from this world. So I need to find sources who will tell me what's happening in this world, and allow them to influence what I write and what I think and what I teach.
You talk about how, you know, Charlie seemed to have, in the book you say, not necessarily explicitly laid down what his kind of ideal global economic system would look like, but you're trying to sort of tease out what it is his kind of goals or what the aim for. You mentioned, use that phrase, Darwinian evolution, to sort of describe, you know, his sense that there was a direction that the global financial system was heading towards and that his role was to kind of help shepherd it along. So, you know, what type of global monetary system do you think that Charlie was envisioning ultimately?
Oh, well, he was definitely envisioning a global dollar system. Meaning that the dollar would be the medium means of payment, and the international currency, so that when you're running a balance of payments deficit, it's dollars, okay, that you have to come up with. And he thought that would be a good system. You know, as I repeat from the beginning, that this isn't about dollar hegemony. You use the word hegemony. It's really about key currency, that there's a kind of public goods aspect of that, that having a unified global monetary system is good for everybody, in the same way that having a unified monetary system inside the United States is good for everyone. It is a hierarchical system, and that makes the people who are in the periphery sort of discontent with it. And not even the distant periphery, okay? Certainly France was not happy with the role of the dollar. And periodically there are problems like this. So the political challenge of global money is serious, because the nation state is not is where government happens, is where politics happen. And the Westphalian kind of image that all politicians sort of have, like, my country is a sovereign country and it's just as good as your country. And so that means that the global dollar system rubs a little badly. Okay. And why isn't my currency treated with respect or something? And the answer, okay, is that money is really kind of a business thing. Okay. That it emerges from the behavior, from the choices that banks and business and global corporations make. So what kind of system did he, it's important to, I think, to appreciate that his image of the problem of the global system emerging from World War II was very much influenced by Alvin Hansen's stagnation hypothesis. Okay, some notion that the global North was kind of washed up. You know, they were mature economies. U.S. had been a very dynamic economy. It had been a developing country for a long time, but now it was old. Okay, and Europe is even older. And so, where is the engine going to be for the global economy? And it's going to be the global South. That's what he thought. That's what Hansen thought. And so that is a challenge for the international monetary and financial system. Like, we can run the Tennessee Valley Authority sort of inside the United States as an anti-depression measure for developing the underdeveloped parts of the United States. what we need to do is to run the analogy to that, the analog to that globally. Okay. Which, but how do you do that? You know, because it's not one government. So that's why he and his friends always viewed the World Bank as the more important creation at Bretton Woods, more important than the IMF, because this is about capital flows. This is about development. Public funds, okay, but hopefully, just like the Tennessee Valley Authority, sort of creating the conditions that would attract private investment later on. And he thought that was important for the United States, you know, that we need a global engine of growth. And so we should help the development ambitions of the global South. It's good for us, okay, and good for others too. But there again, you run into political problems. You know, that would mean allowing the global South to undercut, you know, domestic producers, and therefore forcing you to let those businesses go, you know, but of course those businesses have congressmen, okay? And those congressmen vote for tariffs. And so there is a challenge to building that idea. He didn't live really to see much in the way of global capital flows. He kind of imagined for a while that the multinational corporation might be a vehicle for this, but that proved not so much to be the case for capital flows, because the multinational corporation is largely financing its foreign operations domestically in those countries. So there's not really that much, or what looks like capital flow is tax evasion, he would probably see today. Maybe that was happening then too. The big challenge is getting private capital flow to go. And so I think he would be very interested in the fact that since the global financial crisis of 2008-09, the growth in dollar credit globally has largely been in the global South, because we had zero interest rate policy in the North and new regulation and balance sheet repair for about a decade. So there has not really been aggregate credit expansion in the North. It's all been in the South, basically for the first time in history. So this is 50 years after he was pushing such a thing. So maybe it was Darwinian evolution, you know, that eventually the world found its way toward this thing, but it couldn't be planned. And the political obstacles could be overcome, but not by politicians, you know, by a global financial crisis and other mechanisms. So, you know, evolution works in mysterious ways. And it's not something that you can particularly plan, but you can watch it and then notice it in retrospect and say, look at that. Now look at that. We're testing all of this. You know, this is an expansion to the global South, and all the debt sustainability problems that are emerging right now are the way that the system says, okay, what parts of that were a good idea and what parts of that were not a good idea. And I think that it will, however, be a part of the future. It's not going to go away. Okay. It's just going to shift gears and maybe be more directed or more cautious, or I don't know what. But it's not going to, I think this is a part of our future, is the globalized dollar system that is now integrating the global South more. Most of Charlie's life was about integrating Europe. and then to some extent, Asia was and the Asian financial crisis and so forth. But now it really is the global South more generally. And he would, I think, see that as a good thing, a natural evolution of the system, and something to be not fought against, but encouraged and managed, because of course it's not good for all people, and it's change is hard, and socially hard, and so he's not a laissez-faire guy really, you know, at all. But neither is he a planning guy. So that means that he's a little hard to pigeonhole in the sort of right left spectrum where that is the normal political debate, but that's what makes him interesting as a thinker, I think.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And it comes through. And I think it's one of those, it's a useful book to read just for anyone who finds themselves, you know, maybe caught up in that binary, like for economic students who are trying to figure out whether or not they're going to go Milton Friedman or Karl Marx, you know, Charlie offers a different path. And sort of picking up, going to that, you know, one thing that we haven't discussed, but I think is the thing that people probably know Charlie for most is his work on panics and crises. Is his work as a as you put it, not an economic historian but a historical economist. So you know, if you could just for my final question, talk a little bit about how he thought about economic crises. You know, the Great Depression. What was the work that he was doing there? Why devote his life, the end of his life, to really studying these topics?
Well, Mises, Panics and Crashes is, in fact, his best-known book. It's now coming out in an eighth edition, so it has survived longer than he did. But I think it's a misunderstood book. It's often understood as kind of like, oh, here are these really exciting list of exciting events. That isn't this fun to like catalog them, and. That's not what he was trying to do, okay? He was trying in this book to affect economics, okay? To say, here's a phenomenon, okay, that is nowhere in your models, okay? That is everywhere in the actual world, okay? So that maybe suggests that we should make some advances in economic theory. And it is everywhere. So that is to say, there seems to be something economically law-like about this, you know, that it is fundamental to the way the system works. And so here was his basic idea that, and I think it was really mostly his idea. He hangs it on Minsky, but if you compare him with Minsky, and you've read everything that Charlie wrote before that, you recognize this is continuous with him, and he's just looking for allies, really, you know, that's why he pretends to hang it on Minsky, actually, I think, is that he's looking for allies, which he could use some. So this book was published in 1978, okay, and it is really a follow-on from the Depression book, which was published in 73, okay, where the Depression book is about two basically crises, 29 and 31, so the stock market crash and the sterling devaluation in 31. Two successive crashes that proved to be too much for the international monetary system to absorb. Now he goes back and he looks at all the ones he can find, okay? And he notices a sort of pattern that seems to be general, okay? Which is that something comes along that is, he calls it displacement. It's often a war, okay? Where suddenly there's a lot of pressure to do things differently. Old ways aren't going to be enough. You need to win the war. And money flows in different directions. And then maybe after the war, there's a reparations. And so money flows in another direction. So there's some big displacement that gets going. And once it gets going, it feeds on itself. And it creates a kind of asset bubble that feeds on itself and until it burns out. Okay, and then it's a little bit of a collapse. And a lot of that on the way up, this is about monetizing credit. So it's an expansion of money as well as credit. And so on the way down, everyone is fleeing for the exits. And the key thing there is what kind of international lender of last resort is there in order to prevent this from continuing to build on itself on the way down. And that's the main idea, that the world needs an international lender of last resort, and that for the present purposes, that's got to be the Fed, okay? But how can it be the Fed? Because the Fed is only supposed to care about the United States and not about the rest of the world. So that's a political challenge for the United States, but it's also a political challenge for the rest of the world to let the Fed be the leader and to be the follower. So this was a critique of economics. This is a critique. It was a much more, in his mind, a much more contribution to economic theory, not just a lot of fun stories. And if you read it that way, you will see that is what he intended. But most people don't read it that way. And then he followed that up with what he thought of as his magnum opus was A Financial History of Western Europe, which is, I think, of a treatise on money. So the three big history books: World and Depression, Mises, Panics and Crashes, and and financial history of Western Europe are a package. Okay, these are the product of his third career, and I think they tell kind of a unified message. If you can get a used copy of the first edition of Manias, Panics, and Crashes, which I had and which I used in the book. I did not read the later editions because some of those, there were co-authors and they got changed after he died and passed it on. And so I'm interested in following Charlie. So I'm following that. But I've now read all the rest of the editions, and I've written a little paper about what happened to that, you know, and how did that book get to be kind of misunderstood? And there's going to be lots more spinoffs, Caleb. Believe you me, this is there's a lot on the cutting room floor here, and so I'm going to be doing spinoffs for a while, even as I begin my fifth book, which hopefully I will survive long enough to produce. It takes me a while to produce these books.
And it can definitely tell that. It was, you know, we were talking earlier, the research in this is, you know, it's very, there's a lot of citations all throughout. It's very clear that you spent a lot of time with the man. Do you mind if I ask what the fifth book is, what you're working on?
Oh, I mentioned it before. I'm basically taking the MOOC, the Economics of Money and Banking, which was filmed in 2012, and so therefore kind of stuck in history right back then. And when I didn't know any international finance, and lots has happened since then, you know, since 2012, and so it's time to update that, and I think to turn it into a book, not another MOOC, but a book. So I've been working through that with my class here at Boston University, and I've got lots of ideas on what needs to be done to that. And I'm going to start working on it just as soon as I grade my finals.
Well, good luck with that. I'm looking forward to reading it someday.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, Perry, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. It was great to speak with you about Money and Empire, Charles B. Kindleberger, and the Dollar System. I recommend people go and check it out.
Thanks, Caleb. This is fun.